Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we are going to be speaking to the wonderful poets Miriam Sagan and V.B. Price, who are going to be reading in Santa Fe tomorrow. Right now, I would like to welcome Janice Quinn. She's the executive director of CASA, court-appointed special advocates, and Susie Borgo, who is with CASA's Power. She's CASA's Power Up coordinator, and she's also a volunteer. She is a CASA herself and a board member. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
It's great to have you. First of all, court-appointed special advocates, CASA. What is CASA?
CASA is a group of community volunteers who are trained in the social services and the child abuse legal system to be able to take a case of a child who's been abused at home and then placed into foster care temporarily, and they advocate for the best interest of those children while they're in the court system and in foster care.
And so what does that person actually do? I mean, first of all, they're taking a young person with a whole lot of challenges and trying to work with them.
Right. And this is, let me just start off by saying, this is not a big brother, big sister type of an organization. We are court-appointed advocates appointed by the judge to investigate and interview and get to know everybody involved in the child's life, not to try to prove anything that happened in the past, but try to see what is best for the child right now. Are they getting the services they need? Are they doing okay in school? How's therapy sessions going? What's it like at the foster home? Is what they need being done for them by the state so that they can heal at the same time that their parents are having to go through treatment that's court-ordered to try to correct the problems that caused the kids to be removed in the first place?
What are some of those problems?
Oh, here in our district, we cover Santa Fe, Rio, Riva, and Los Alamos counties. And there's a lot of substance abuse, alcohol, there's some mental health problems, there's a lot of drug abuse, and there's a lot of just pure neglect, meaning there's not enough food, there's not enough care, there's not enough supervision, there's not enough medical needs being met by the kids. Those are our main problems.
So, the kids have kind of a pretty poor set of choices. They can either stay in that situation or they can be put into foster care. Foster care isn't always a walk in the park either.
No, it's not. You know, the state tries to be a good parent, but the state doesn't make a good parent. Fortunately, we have some great foster homes around the area. We don't have enough. If anybody out there is looking to do something really wonderful in their lives, they can become foster parents. But the kids don't really have a choice. The state decides that they are not safe at home and they remove them from the homes. And so the kids don't have a choice of where to go.
And so when the kids go into foster care, what kind of needs do they have? I mean, it's certainly, especially depending on the age, there could be a tremendous amount of trauma involved just simply in being taken away from their home, no matter how bad it was
right. In
the home.
Yeah, that's really true. Unfortunately, well, the needs vary quite a bit. Some of them are physically abused, you know, some of them are sexually abused, some of them are mentally or emotionally abused. And on top of all that, if there's not a foster home in the area where they've gone to school, they go to a new school, they have a new home, they have a new neighborhood, they've left all their friends, their dogs, their belongings behind. So there's a lot of fear in these kids. They get therapy sessions, they have supervised visits with their parents, but they really need somebody who's just going to be there for them, because the systems that's trying to take care of them are pretty overworked, overwhelmed. There's a lot of change in social workers for them, so those people come and go. There's a scary, you know, attorney, there's a scary courtroom. All of it's pretty scary for these kids. And so the CASA is the one person that's not getting paid and is just there for them from the beginning of the case to the very end of it, until we know where they're going to go for good.
And so it's not a big brother, big sister, and yet there probably is emotionally some of that feeling to it.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. The kids sometimes take 2 or 3 months to trust the CASA because there's not a lot of trust in their lives. But once they do, it's amazing the change that we see in them when they start to open up and realize that somebody really does care about their welfare. You know, they tell us a lot of secrets. They start to change in their behavior. Their attitudes get a little brighter. You know, they get hope.
What ages are we talking about? What age of children?
0 to 18. Some kids are taken away from their parents at birth because they're born drug affected. So right away from the hospital, they go into care.
And they go into foster care. Are some of these children up for adoption? What determines whether they're up for adoption or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a whole court case that happens, and it takes about 15 months at the minimum. And the court has to decide if the parents can make themselves healthy and make their homes safe enough for the kids to come back to their homes. If they can't, then the choice is that they relinquish their rights to be parents, or the court takes their rights to be parents away from them. And only after that are the kids actually freed legally for adoption.
And have you seen, you've seen cases like this, certainly.
Oh yeah.
Do the majority of foster kids get taken away permanently, or do they go back to their parents?
You know, the state stats say that about 69% of the kids are returned. I think here in our district, we don't see that. We see more like maybe 50% of the kids are returned home.
So half the kids who are taken away from their parents for all these horrible reasons never go back to their parents.
Right. Except when they age out of the system, when they turn that adult at 18 and they're no longer in the system and they can do what they want to do or what they're able to do. A lot of them do try to find their parents again. A lot of them do go home.
Now, aging out of the system is something that is also a little scary, because the statistics on foster kids aging out of the system are not very good.
No, they're not. I'd like Susie to talk about that.
Yeah, it's nationally, we don't keep very good statistics, because once these kids are out of the system, they're out of our view. But we know many little pieces of the puzzle, and they add up to a lot more incidents of all the problems that people get into in their lives. Higher incidents of incarceration, higher pregnancy and early parenting, more drug abuse, lots of problems that these kids get into, not because they're bad kids, but because they've had a lot of things to deal with in their lives.
Now, before we went on the air, you were saying something about, where was it they count the, they, go ahead, what?
There's a book called The Invisible Child, and the quote in it is that there's at least one state in the country that counts the number of kids in Child Protective Services to determine their future prison needs, because they've shown across the country that 90% of the kids in juvenile justice were abused at home, and 90% of adult criminals incarcerated were in the juvenile justice system. So all they have to do is look at the kids who have been abused, and they know how many adult criminals we're going to have.
Amazing.
It is amazing. It's something we have to find a way to break. We've got to break that chain.
I mean, you guys are doing it at the level of working with these young people, and we'll talk more about the Power Up in a moment. But what do you see as the roots of the problem?
Of the child abuse problem?
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know. That's a large question. In New Mexico, we see a lot of multi-generational abuse. We see multi-generational problems with drugs, with alcohol. We see some developmental delays. A lot of our parents were special ed kids that never got the services they really need. They have children young. There's a problem with young parents, because their babies are usually born underweight and they're not nourished.
When you say young, you mean like really young?
Like 15, 16, 17-year-old moms.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, one of the biggest heartbreaks since I've been doing this work is actually seeing a child who grew up in foster care then become the mother of a child that is now in foster care.
Oh, Lord.
So, I mean, when you see
those... You've been doing this work a while.
Only 5 years.
And we have cases with grandmothers, mothers, and kids all involved in the same case, because the families are so young.
Right. So those are the things that we're faced with. Thank goodness we have incredible volunteers, though. And the volunteers, the work that they do really change these kids' lives.
Now, we're talking, by the way, to Janice Quinn and Susie Borgo of CASA, which stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates. What are some of the ways? Well, you, Susie, are a CASA volunteer.
Uh-huh.
Without revealing any, details that you can't reveal, but, what's your work like? What are some of your cases like that you've had?
I've had about 5 cases. I've been in CASA since 2003, mostly in Rio Riva County. And they vary greatly. I have had more small children than I have had older children in my cases, which is kind of ironic since I've become involved with the teen program recently. They really vary a lot. There's a lot of drug abuse in the parents. There's physical violence in some cases, domestic violence that's gone on for a long time. Most of my cases have had multiple children, so we get involved with the dynamics among the larger family. I've had two cases that were the children were ultimately adopted by grandparents. And the grandparents who may have not been great parents the first time around are turning out to be wonderful parents the second time around, which is really nice and keeps the kids in their extended family. So it's a challenge. We work with everybody on the case. These are cases where attorneys often have 40, 50, 60 cases. The attorneys that are appointed for the parents, there is also an attorney appointed for the children, and they have many cases too. So often the cause is the only person that really knows personally the details of everything that's gone on, everything the children need, what happens as the case progresses. So we can be a big help to all the other parties that are appointed by the court.
So not only the child, but also the attorneys and so on, and the judge rely on you.
And we work with CYFD and the social workers.
CYFD, Children, Youth, and Families Department.
Which is the state organization responsible for removing these children and treating these families. We work with them very closely because often they have many cases too. They're very overworked and underpaid, and we can be a big help to them in making sure that these kids stay on track and that the cases work out as best as they can.
Now, you're the coordinator of Power Up, which is the new teen program. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've had this idea for a couple of years, and we've been working to get a little bit of funding for it, and it's part of a state push of New Mexico's making, and a lot of other states are making right now, to put more attention onto the kids that come into the system, usually as teenagers, and often stay for 3 to 5 to 7 years in the system because they are less adoptable to many situations, and they often can't go home to their parents, so they go into a kind of limbo state until they turn 18, and traditionally most states at 18 say, okay, you're on your own, you're an adult now. And most of us who've raised kids know that at 18 they weren't anywhere near ready to be on their own with the best of backgrounds. So these kids are really being asked to do a lot of things that other young people don't have to do, and they have challenges, and I have to tell you, they're amazingly determined, resilient, perseverant, wonderful young people, but they have very large challenges.
So there's a saying that if a child has one caring adult in its life, that it makes a huge difference. I mean, how does that go?
All the research shows that that's the one thing that makes a difference. You can provide lots of other services, lots of other financial support, but the one thing that makes a difference for a young person over the period that they're making this transition is to have significant adult figures in their lives who are just there for a lot of things that we think of as very ordinary and mundane. Life skill help, advice, counseling, someone to talk to, someone who's been around and been through some of the experiences that you're facing. Because when you think about it, we have those things naturally if we come from a two-parent family home, that these kids just don't have anyone. Often they have no family members. They're separated from their siblings. They go to many different schools if they're shifted from foster home to foster home. Changing school during high school is tough on kids. They often have to move in the middle of the semester. They lose credits, so they get behind. It's hard for them to get finished with their high school education, let alone go beyond. So anything we can do to support them, I think, is going to be helpful.
And so how are these relationships structured in the new program?
What we're hoping to do, we just started up in October, so we're just getting off the ground. We're going to build a very elaborate website that these kids can access directly with a lot of information that they might not know how to find otherwise or would be difficult to find. We're going to train CASAs. And the CASAs that are working with teens now and that would like to work with more teens in the future are going to get extra help on the kinds of ways that they can be better mentors, better advocates, better adult role models for these teens. And we're hoping that ultimately some of these folks will stick with these teens after they age out of the system. So they'll become like community mentors for these kids.
And is it then more like a big brother, big sister type of thing?
It is a little bit more, I think, at that point, yeah. Because while we're in our role as CASAs, we're limited in what we can do. We really can't be friend because we have to look out for the best interests of the child. So we have a court-appointed responsibility to see the whole picture of the case. But once we're not a CASA anymore, we can be whatever works out.
So there are 2,500 New Mexican children in foster care.
Right.
That's a lot of kids.
That's a lot of kids, yeah. There's over 500,000 in the United States at any one day.
And the Heart Gallery, for example, whom you partner with, does wonderful work in trying to get some of these young people adopted, but most of them are just struggling.
Yeah, they are. They are. And as Susie said, you know, they're incredibly resilient. There's some just brilliant kids amongst them. We have one of them on our board as an advisor, and she's just turned 21, and she was in care from the time she was 12 years old, and so, you know, we get firsthand kind of a consultation, you know, with our clients.
So she keeps you honest about
Yeah, she keeps
what
us real.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so have some of these power-up relationships happened yet? Are those starting to develop, or is it too new to really talk about?
It's really pretty new because we're just starting to figure out all the aspects of the program. But we have many CASAs with relationships with teens already. We haven't labeled it power up in
right.
the past.
Yeah.
But, right. And some of them will be lifetime relationships.
Now, you are looking for more volunteers, of course.
Absolutely.
And you have a pretty extensive training.
Right. We do training twice a year in the spring and in the fall, and this training starts on March the 19th. It's about 24 hours of in-class training, and there's some homework and reading to do, and there's some court observation to do as well. And once the CASAs go through the training, they get training by the professionals, by therapists, by social workers, by our attorneys. Our judge talks to them. Judge Barbara V. Hill is a children's court judge in our district, and she swears them into an oath of confidentiality. And then they're able to take a case and start to work with the kids.
And then if they have problems or questions as they're going along, do they have, what would you call it, supervision or somebody to go to?
Absolutely. We have three staff members now. We're so excited to have a second volunteer coordinator in our program. And we have four experienced CASAs who are called advocate coordinators. And they're cleared by the court to know all the details about these confidential cases. And so any CASA can go to them for advice on how to get through sticky situations or just, you know, just to be their mentor and supervisor.
What kind of sticky situations come up?
Well, sometimes new CASAs are a little hesitant to go into a foster home, you know, to visit with the kids. They don't really know how to act, or sometimes they need information from a therapist and they're not sure how to get that. What would you say,
That's
Susie?
That's not so sticky.
Well, okay. Susie, you go.
Sometimes we're at cross purposes with some of the other professionals on the case, and it takes a lot of tact to deal with the situations, and new CASAs sometimes would like to talk to more experienced folks who've been around other situations.
So what would be an example of people being at cross purposes with one another?
It's not so, I guess cross purposes is maybe an exaggeration, but sometimes we have different views on where the case is and what needs to happen. Sometimes we become aware of a situation that possibly no one else has seen, and then it's an issue of how do we get that information to the folks who need to take some action.
Sometimes the wheels move a little slower than CASAs would like them to.
Yeah, we're working with bureaucracy. And
well, all of this is something that our listeners may participate in if they want to. How do they find out more about CASA?
Well, you can call us at 820-1500 in Santa Fe. We have a website that has the application, and to become a CASA, you do have to apply, and we do background checks, of course, criminal and abuse background checks. And we
do you ever find references. Somebody's applied who ended up being abusive?
No, our CASAs are pretty smart, so we don't get people who are doing that. But you can go to our website, which is www.casafirst.org.
CASAfirst.org.
Right, and you spell first out.
And so they can call you at 820-1500 or go to the website. Anything else that you want to let people know about?
Well, CASAs make an incredible difference in these children's lives. And once a child has a CASA, they have a better attitude about the future. They have fewer foster care placement changes, which is really important for their stability and their mental health. They get out of the system faster. They're more likely to land in permanent homes so they don't come back into foster care. They're not re-abused. And it's just, it's better for everybody, even for their families. They get better services as well.
I just like to say that as a volunteer, this is the most satisfying, challenging work that I've ever done, more than the professional work I did in my life. And I would recommend it highly to anyone that wants to make a difference in our community.
Do you have a lot of people who are retired, who've gone through a whole other profession and then have a little bit more time on their hands?
We do, but it's about 50% retired and 50% still working full-time or part-time.
Really?
So, yeah, we're across the board. We have single moms. We have retired nuclear physicists. We have school teachers. We have artists. It's just it's a great gamut. That's the other nice thing about becoming a CASA. You meet a bunch of really interesting people.
Very true.
Janice Quinn is the executive director of CASA, and Susie Borgo is CASA's Power Up Coordinator. She's a board member and volunteer as well. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mary.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Santa Fe Waldorf School, established in 1983, offering a unique education that integrates academics, the arts, and experiential learning for preschool through 12th grade. Currently enrolling all grades for the 2008-2009 school year. Reserve space now for a visitor morning and see what Waldorf education is all about. For more information, call 983-9727 or visit santafewaldorf.org. Santa Fe Waldorf School is a nonprofit organization.
What a life to live in a place with a tropical beach where you can snorkel, play in the surf, and enjoy palm trees, crystal blue water, and miles of sand. You know, a place like Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now that FrontierAirlines.com offers nonstop flights from Albuquerque to Puerto Vallarta, it means that Albuquerque's beach is just a short flight away. KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the City of Albuquerque.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Santa Fe Farmers Market. The market reminds you that great locally grown food is available all winter long at the indoor market at 519 Cerrillos Road, just north of Paseo de Peralta, on Saturdays from 9 to 1. The indoor market features meats, cheeses, nuts, apples, greens, tomatoes, and other veggies, as well as baked goods, juices, jams, condiments, dried chile, and more. More information at 983-4098 or santafefarmersmarket.com.
I'd like now to welcome Miriam Sagan and V.B. Price. Miriam Sagan is here in the cafe, and V.B. Price is joining us by telephone. And they will both be reading tomorrow at a reading as part of the Poets Night series at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe. And Miriam Sagan has a new book called Map of the Lost, and V.B. Price's most recent book, Broken and Reset, both of them published by the University of New Mexico Press. Welcome.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great. I can't believe that I'm actually talking to you. Good morning.
It's a long way away.
I know. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Yeah, me too, you.
The glories of complicated high-tech modern technology known as the telephone.
Absolutely.
Miriam, your new book is Map of the Lost. This is a thick little volume of poetry. Is this all new work?
This is a thick little volume of poetry, yes, and actually it's because of Barrett, who was the editor, that it's as thick as it is. It's all new work, and it was written pretty fast and kind of white heat.
Really? I find this so fascinating. You are so prolific. As we learned in your last book, Gossip, you have no work ethic. How does this work?
Well, I don't know if Barrett would agree with me, but it worked because he said, I'd like a book of yours. And I had thought, oh, maybe he wants some old poems. And he said, I want some new poems, and I want about 100 pages, and I want them by October. So so I had no work ethic, but I had a muse. I had a demand. How does that sound?
God, now, are they wonderful poems, too. They're so beautiful.
Very amazing poems. A lot of your poems seem to originate in the observation of daily life. What do you do? Do you stop what you're doing and write a poem? Do you make notes? Do you think back on your day?
You know, that actually, it's a cool question because it's actually not those things. I do think that writing poetry is a habit of mind, that it's like a meditative or contemplative practice. It's a practice of observing so that what I actually see is I see the poem. It's not created first in words. It's actually created first in perception. But it's, you know, while somebody else might be looking at the pile of laundry and saying, I need to wash this laundry, I'm looking at the pile of laundry and I'm saying, what does laundry mean to me? Is the beautiful light coming off the laundry?
When you say you see the poem before you have the words, what does that mean?
I think it's that actually, if people were to slow down, they would see all the contrast and metaphor that's around us all the time. And so I'm looking for it, if that makes sense.
Yes, very interesting. There are many textile images. We found this in your book, Rag Trade, as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I was raised in the garment industry. My father was in the coat manufacturing business. And a really deep thing for me is that image of a person feeling a fabric between their thumb and their finger. And textiles, you know, not only are they very beautiful, often they're made by women, but they're also, to me, about cultural exchange, about things that move around.
So would you like to, let's just start off, let's have you read a poem.
I'm happy to read a poem, and in fact, I want to read, a lot of these poems are about Santa Fe and sort of obscure hidden places in Santa Fe, and so I want to read the poem called Heaven and Hell, which is about teenagers. Heaven and Hell. The kids tell me there are tunnels beneath the city, lost cities in the Arroyo, crumbling from abandoned childhood. The lit tunnel is called Heaven, the dark one, Hell. You can go there and do anything. Leave behind a foil wrapper or a used needle. No one will take me there. I'll never be 16 again. Drawing the hopscotch board in chalk, casting the pebble, hopping on one foot from hell across the numbered board to paradise. The city appears solid, but the tunnels, they tell me, start near the mall. And aren't we all strangers, wayfarers, pilgrims?
Miriam Sagan. A lot of them are about Santa Fe as well, about New Mexico. And I was thinking about what it means for you to have lived here for over a quarter century, but still be a Jersey girl inside. It sort of makes you sort of bicultural.
That's exactly right. I like that. It does. I always think I spent my whole adult life here, but I spent a lot of my non-adult life elsewhere. And there's always a paradox for me, too, because my daughter was born here. And what she sees and what I see are very different.
Is that right?
Yeah. When she was little, she said, a river, sometimes it has water in it, and sometimes it doesn't. And I freaked out. I was like, I was raised on the mighty Hudson, where there's always water. But
very interesting. What is the significance of the title, Map of the Lost?
A lot of the poems in the book are literal maps. Not all of them, just a handful. But they tell you how to get from, you know, point A to point B. And basically, they're concrete maps of place, of lost Santa Fe, things that used to be in Santa Fe that aren't here anymore. But, you know, I realized I was working so hard on place and geography, and then when the book came out, and it's so beautiful, and I was reading it, I realized, well, this is about my daughter leaving home. This whole book is about a person who starts off as being 12 and a half in the first poem, and by the end is a grown woman. And so what's the actual map of the lost for me? Psychologically, it's about that emotional state of letting go.
Very interesting. We're talking to Miriam Sagan, and V.B. Price is joining us quietly on the telephone. Let's turn now to your work. Well, first of all, you wrote the foreword to Miriam's book, and you also, what would you say? She just said provided the muse, the energy to get this done. What was that process like?
Oh well, I've just always loved her work, and she's been, you know, such an important power in the lives of so many writers in New Mexico. She's done a tremendous amount for people, and I just always loved her work. And so, you know, I had a kind of a wild hair, and I've been editing the Mary Bird Christensen poetry series at UNM for about 4 or 5 years, and I had a chance to ask her if she wouldn't mind doing that for us. And what appeared is just these fabulous, beautiful poems with wonderful mental geographies and habits of mind, as she says, that are just completely compelling.
I have to say, Miriam, the cover of the book, and we shouldn't be judging books by their cover, but it's really beautiful and somehow very fitting to the book of poems.
Well, it's a local artist. It's Gail Reiki's work, which I have long admired, and, you know, she has that tremendous studio. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And not far from here, you know, she has her open house about once or twice a year, but she's just, I was mesmerized when I saw her work.
And it's the images of stones, and is it lichen?
I think it's snail tracks on a tree. Although you can't tell from looking.
Yes, it's so abstract that it could be just about anything. VB Price, now you go. Do you go by VB or Barrett? Miriam's calling you Barrett.
Yeah, I go by Barrett.
Okay. Well, you published a book last year, Broken and Reset, which spans 40 years of your life.
Right.
So what was it like to go back and do the selection from all your life's work?
Well, it was really an amazing adventure. I've been working for, probably maybe 55 or 60 years as a poet, and there's just so much material. But what I began to see were my preoccupations kind of lumping themselves together with place, with the ancient world, with the Pueblo world around here, with love and with Christmas and with philosophy. And so I sort of tried to put together a book which would not talk so much about my own personal evolution, but which would indeed deal with the process of creating oneself through work.
Well, it's interesting that you put the book in reverse chronology. Why did you do that? And even the numbers go backwards. The first section is 2006 to 1995, something like that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a wonderful question. I think it's a kind of a whim. I think I like my later work more than my earlier work. So.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I like it all. But I didn't want somebody in a bookstore to kind of leaf through and see old stuff first, and not so. it was just a strategy.
One of your recent poems starts as follows. Beginning is always. Who you were is not who you are any more than your name, your aches and pains, your failures, your grand accolades. Now, I was thinking of the line, who you were is not who you are. Do you feel this way when you read your older poems? Were they written by somebody else?
Oh, what a wonderful... That's a great question. You've been reading my stuff. That's wonderful. Yeah, I do. I think we are who we are all our lives, but clearly... we grow and we change, and that is the great redeeming power of maturity. We are all that we have been, but we are also who we are right now and the kinds of choices that we are capable of making right now. And they redeem us and rescue us from the past and from the times in our lives when we were less aware of what was possible.
What does that mean to be rescued from the past?
Oh, I think a lot of us carry around profound scarring from the past, and it takes a tremendous amount of our time and our lives and our attention to unloosen that stuff and to get free of it. It's not that we're all, psychotic or neurotic or anything like that, but I think everybody...
Except just a little.
Maybe just a little. But I think everybody's past impinges on the possibilities of the future. And probably we're all looking for freedom in one way or another, and that's probably the first thing we need to get free of, which is, in some degree, the negativity of the past. So it's just as much a part of us as anything else, and we really don't ever want to shun it, but perhaps understand it.
I was struck by the difference between your poems and Miriam's, looking at them both yesterday on Sunday afternoon, and yours seem much less bound by place, and they seem more interior. Like, I couldn't tell, even though some of them are named after places, you couldn't really tell from the content of the poem where most of them were written. Is that on purpose, or do you feel that connection to place in your work?
Oh, yeah, I do, but I think the places just internalized themselves in me so much that I'm just kind of there, and the images that appear while I'm there seem to appear on the page. I write to see what's going on in my interior life, and sometimes... places just overwhelm me and occupy me, and I think probably become so internalized that the place names and the specifics don't oftentimes make it into the work.
It's interesting. It's nice to hear somebody say they write to see what's going on, as opposed to they write to communicate or something like that.
Well, I think all of us want to want to be heard, but I kind of like to listen more than talk. I'm not a great speaker because I used to stutter as a kid, and so I like to listen to others, and I like to listen to myself too. But the best way to do that is on the page.
That's interesting. So then it's sort of poetry as a receptive process of listening to the self.
Yeah, I think so in a lot of ways. I think poetry is also an instrument of perception. So you see through poems what only they can see. And so when you're attentive to what you're seeing in that mode, all kinds of things appear, all kinds of magical things. And it is a habit of mind, as Miriam says, and it's a way of life.
Miriam is sitting here nodding very, very happily.
I am. I'm enjoying what you're saying.
yeah.
Now, V.B. Price, Barrett Price, yeah. You have made your living as a reporter, columnist, nonfiction writer, editor, and novelist. How do these various forms of writing work with one another? How do they feed each other or interact or not interact?
That's another great question. I've been a reporter, for almost 45 years. So, in a way, I'm listening to the world in the same way as I am listening to the world as it resonates through me. And I've always been attracted to other people's work. I'm really interested in the role that the good editors have played in my life, and which is really an energizing role, and I've kind of hoped in some small way I can do that for other people as well. But I love other writers; they just inspire me, and they make me know that I'm not alone, and that the world is filled with unimaginably interesting people. So I think how things connect. I think some would say that one writes across the spectrum, but I think to be a good columnist, you have to know the language just about as well as you do to be a good poet. And the world, when you're a reporter and a nonfiction writer, is open to you in a way that it isn't open to other people who don't have to respond to it in some kind of articulate way.
Yeah, I was wondering if you reserved different different kinds of thinking for your non-poetic writing. For example, I mean, again, this sense of place and the sort of storytelling that we find in Miriam's poetry. I was thinking, oh, I bet that comes out in your reporting or your fiction writing.
Yeah, it does actually. I think the poems about Chaco Canyon, however, are very, very deeply place rooted. But indeed, right now I'm working on a kind of look at the environment of New Mexico, the natural environment as it's been impacted by humans since the Manhattan Project, and that's tremendously place bound, and deals with all kinds of contamination, pollution, and things. And so I am right there, exactly where I'm living and where we all live, as a reporter.
And, for example, would that kind of material work its way into your poetry?
Yes, in one way or another, in probably oblique ways, but yes, for sure.
Now, in the introduction to your book, you write that you are, quote, eccentric in the sense of needing to be utterly free while well disguised in normalcy. What does it mean to be utterly free? I think many of our listeners would like to know.
Well, I think it's an aspiration rather than an achievement. As a writer, I want to do what I'm doing, not what I want to do or what I think I should do or what others want me to do, but what happens to me when I write, which is largely unpredictable. I want to be free in that sense. I also, am an ardent constitutionalist. So I want to be free as an American, too. Freedom has lots and lots of different valences and aspects. But I think as a writer, one does not want to be hedged in by expectation, by schools, by critics particularly. One wants to do what the muse gives one to do.
How do you get the muse to work with you?
I'm going to say in absolute and total honesty that I adore her. She gives me everything. I am completely and absolutely at her service. She has been as good to me as anyone could possibly be, and I am endlessly and eternally grateful.
Miriam Price, do you work with this concept of the muse, which is traditionally a male artist, female invisible muse kind of thing, or real muse?
I'm close to Barrett, which is my feeling about the muse is definitely female, sort of goddessy and kind of out there and a little bit scary. And when I was in college, I had this feeling. It was like puberty. I felt like something was trying to take over my body, and I was wandering around. Of course, I mean, I'm like 19, so I'm sort of hysterical, and I'm wandering around by the Charles River, feeling that I'm, having a case of romantic possession. And I walk back into this, dorm room and try to explain to a bunch of friends of mine that, I've just had this ecstatic experience, and they're basically, so what? who are you, and can you make money? And so it tends to be, I think, for poets, a somewhat private thing, so I'm amazed that Barrett would just say that. But I agree with him. I think for me and for a lot of poets, there's a feeling of gratitude that no matter what psychological explanation you give for creativity, the experiences is that it's given to you, that it comes from beyond. There's a quality of the divine or quality of a gift.
Do you feel that each poem comes from beyond?
I don't really like the poems that don't come from beyond. I'm not to sound like, Roswell aliens or something, but I tend to ditch the poems that are overly constructed or overly made from my need to make something. They don't tend to really work.
Very interesting. What about you, Barrett?
I think they definitely come to me, but they come to me in bits and pieces. I usually write I write every morning, and I usually get what an old pal of mine used to call pop-ups. They sort of appear, and then I look at them and pay attention to them and see where they want to go. And inevitably, when I'm trying too hard to lead them by the hand, I get wrecked. But when I listen and pay attention and move along with them, they blossom and become what they're supposed to be.
Would you like to read a poem right now?
Yeah, I would. I'd love to. I'd like to read a poem about a wonderful curve of land, oddly enough, outside of Laramie, Wyoming, and listening to Beethoven's Seventh while driving along it with my wife, Renee. It's called Laramie, and it's from a collection of poems called The High Alone, which is in this book. Laramie. Beethoven grass, teasing and rolling through the high alone, surrounding us with inner spaces as far as we can breathe, intimate as not being seen, as soulmates conversing over supper, rising and falling with each other, fitting perfectly as geology and weather, as bone and the chemistry of ideas. Politics is seen for what it is, death house green gas storage tanks and pipelines, fiscal zits defining, benign by those money-making, by those making money for themselves from what belongs to all of us, wanting to steal that future rising in us as our whole true being with each other under the sky. Among the notes swelling across the plain, money is just ticks and lice in the beautiful fur of the music bounding over the hill.
We're talking to V.B. Price, Barrett Price, and this is from his new collection of poems, selected poems, Broken and Reset, 1966 to 2006. Now, something that I always wonder about poetry. I mean, you just told us that you were driving through the countryside listening to Beethoven with your wife, and so now we understand the poem better. But most people don't have the privilege of knowing what the context was, and that always bothers me. Like, how are we supposed to understand Beethoven grass if we don't know that you were driving?
driving through the countryside listening to Beethoven 7th?
Well, you know, I think there's a hope that from time to time, you know, I don't know how to answer that question. It's a great one. Eliot used to call this thing the objective correlative, but that's way too academic. I would hope that somebody has had a similar experience in which they've been listening to Beethoven and looking at grass moving.
Miriam Sagan, would you like to read another poem?
You know, I will, and I'll read something that actually has reference to a lot of what we've been talking about. In this poem, it says, "When the state was closed," which sounds large and philosophical, but actually it's about a snow day in Santa Fe, so the state was closed. And also, it has a mention of taking dictation for a poet, rather than making it up as if it's overheard. And it's called Kore, which of course just means girl in Greek. It means a young girl, a maiden. And this, it does relate to the mother poems in the book. Kore, snowfall. All night by dawn, shapes are rounded. The bush becomes a beast you must beat with a broom. And some oddity in the neighbor's yard appears to be a stovepipe poking through the Arctic waste. I was nervous in both darkness and light, inspecting a bruise, expecting a letter in a white envelope. Maybe a thin aerogram from the realm of the dead. On a day without news, when the state was closed, where footprints seemed more permanent than usual, and I took dictation as if from the radio or music. Where red finches slipped in and out of the thorn bush fence, and I wondered about the unexpected, about who was caught in snares and who ran free all day, and couldn't make anything of my dreams, and was waiting for my daughter to appear in a nightgown, a white slip dress, with a bruise on her neck, love's bite from a boy I'd never seen.
Miriam Sagan, I love the poems about your daughter.
Oh, well, thank you. I let her read the book and asked her if she wanted to take anything out.
Really? She had veto power?
She had veto power.
Did she use it?
No, she was very nice. She just left everything in.
What does she think about all these poems about herself?
Well, actually, she said that I made her sound wild and groovy and bad, and that was okay.
That's right. She can take it to college with her.
Exactly.
Barrett Price, you rediscovered ancient mythology as an adult while teaching college students, and some of these mythological characters come up in your poetry. What was it like to work with people like Zeus and Hera and Pan and Apollo and so on, as opposed to reading them when you were a young person?
It was wonderful. I think the Greek gods really do get into the heart of what it means to be a human being, and they've just delighted me and enlightened me from day one. And it's particularly interesting to read them as an adult when you have all kinds of experiences. I mean, you know, we've all lived with Zeus, the awful big daddy abuser from time to time, and with Hera, the evil stepmother, and with all kinds of things. So it's been a great joy for me to see those things.
It's interesting. You were saying that you liked your more recent poems better, and indeed, they take up more than half of the book, and then the last less than half is the other 30 years of poems. What happened? I mean, were you really just more prolific recently, or you just like the recent ones better?
I think I just like the recent ones better. I we grow and change, and I hope that's what I've been doing. It's growing and changing, although one day I think I would like to do a book of a lot of early work, but this was what I wanted to do this time.
What's the significance of the title, Broken and Reset?
I think probably it means, in one way or another, that at some point in our lives we have to undo the mends that other people make on us during the maturation process and choose to be who we really are. And in that process, we have to break those mends and then reset ourselves on the right path, a path to where we think we should be.
We have just 2 minutes left. Would you like to read one more poem?
I would. I'd like to read a poem that my wife likes a lot. It's called The Cyclops' Garden, and it's a love poem. And it goes like this. To whom it may concern, as proof of my good faith contrition, my devout submission to romance, I'll simply split this eye right down the middle, slit it deep as my nail will go, part the edges smartly back, lay to rest a cherry pit inside, then wait till spring, till you pass by, for it to blossom. Love is blind.
That's great.
So, we have another minute left, but what is your reading going to be like tomorrow night, Miriam Sagan, at Collected Works Bookstore?
It's going to be lovely. We haven't worked out how we're going to read, but probably in just a set of two, and nice cozy setting, and people who know us both.
Refreshments,
exactly.
But do you go back and forth with each other? Do you talk with each other about the work in public? I think it's always so interesting to hear poets commenting on each other's work.
You know, as a rule, it's not done, but you gave us the opportunity today to do it a little bit.
Well, good. We are very happy to do so. Miriam Sagan is the author of over 20 books, and the most recent one is called Map of the Lost. It's a thick new book, well, not that thick, but over 100 pages, which is quite something, of new poetry. And V.B. Price's most recent book is called Broken and Reset. They're both published by the University of New Mexico Press. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Bless you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. Oh, by the way, I just want to remind people that this reading tomorrow night, Tuesday, February 12th, is at 5:30 at Collected Works Bookstore as part of Poets Night series at Collected Works, and that is in Santa Fe on West San Francisco Street, right across the street from the Lenzic Theater. So, yes, this is the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.